All right, welcome to another episode of the Spotlight Conversations on the Postdoc Way. I'm your host, Brian Jarecki. I'm very excited to have our guest today, David Giltner. He is a product manager from Zolo Technologies. He received his PhD in physics from Colorado State University, and he is an author of a recently published book called Turning Science into Things People Need. This features 10 stories from scientists who have built successful and rewarding careers in industry. So welcome, David.
Thank you. Sure. Glad to be here.
Yeah, very nice of you to come talk to us. I'm really excited to hear what you have to say because there's a lot of overlap with your book and some of the experience that you have and some of the insight that you have, very similar to what I'm trying to do with some of these podcasts. So I was curious, first off, if you can just explain in a little bit more detail who you are and what your experience is.
Sure. So as you mentioned, my degree is in physics, mm-hmm. and I did my research specifically in laser spectroscopy, a mix of precision measurements, but also some work in optics, moving atoms around with laser light, a relatively growing field at the time. Mm-hmm. But I spent my entire career since then in industry on working in companies that did a variety of different kinds of laser-based products. That was sort of my in, part of this whole challenge of how do you go from basic research to industry. Well, mm-hmm. I started by thinking, hey, I've used lasers a lot as a tool in grad school. I learned to take them apart and make them work the best possible, and that became kind of a good inroads into industry mm-hmm. to get a job and say, hey, I can help you sell these because I was once your customer.
Sure.
And that's really what my career has been.
Okay.
Laser products and optical communications mostly. Currently, the company I'm at now, we make combustion sensors that use lasers. We shine them through a large industrial furnace to measure water vapor, oxygen, carbon monoxide, and temperature to help them optimize the efficiency and the emissions.
Okay. So this was, the transition that you made. I was wondering if you can go into a little bit more detail because, as you mentioned, as I mentioned, you actually got your PhD at Colorado State University. So was there a transition point or was there a particular moment that you realized you wanted to make this leap to industry, or was it maybe a combination of a few events or talking to specific people in industry, or was it, as you mentioned, you dealt with these products before, so you have this very intimate knowledge of these spectroscopic and these techniques, these approaches that you're using. So I was curious if you can elaborate on that in a little bit more detail.
Sure. Most of my graduate career, I just assumed I would be a professor.
Okay.
I got into physics because I loved the science. I loved learning about how the world works, and it really seemed to fit me. And undergrad led to grad school, and mm-hmm. grad school just seems to point you at being a professor. It just felt like that's what you do. Mm-hmm. But it was really in my last year that I, after being in graduate school for a number of years and watching how it all worked, I thought, I don't think I want to be a professor. That's not really for me. Part of the influence was my lab partner, a guy named Roger McGowan, mm-hmm. one of the people in my book, actually. And, we were together for a number of years, and he was saying all along he wanted to go into industry. I never thought much about it until that last year. And then we were both at this point where we're going, wow, we want to go out into industry, but we don't really have a good feeling what's there at all. So, that whole, what sounds like a great idea now, that, hey, I work at lasers, I'll go work at a laser company. Mm-hmm. It took a little while to figure out how to do that. And, but that did work pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
That was really the transition that was really mostly about wanting to do something different. I just didn't see the life of a professor as what fit me that way.
Okay. Now, did you ever have an opportunity to do an internship in industry, or was this something you hadn't thought about until maybe your last year of graduate school?
I did not have that opportunity. Okay. I wasn't even aware of any opportunities like that. And quite frankly, I think this way for many physics grad students, mm-hmm. Your advisor wouldn't necessarily even be interested in that because they want you focused on the research that they're paying you to do.
Right.
They may not be paying you a lot, but they're paying you, to do a little. And they want you to make progress on that, and anything else would take you away from
it. Sure. So,
no, I never even considered it, and I think it's a great idea if the opportunity is there.
Yeah, right. So the I guess the spark that you had, it was while you were in graduate school. Now, one of the most important, opportunities for a lot of graduate students and postdocs to explore some of these possibilities, and I mean, even more basic, just some of the definitions of what these positions are and what and where they're available, what kind of companies are out there, are to do informational interviews. Now, was this something that you pursued? Was this something that you found very helpful to kind of get a better idea of what positions were available to you, or maybe how to make that transition to industry? Because this is something, as I'm interacting with more and more individuals and trying to figure out what kind of scares them the most, this is something that frightens a lot of people. It's they have academic experience, but they have no idea how to translate this to industry. And industry usually wants, you know, a couple to several years of experience. So people are trying to figure out how to get that experience, how to know what it is people in industry are looking for. So I'm curious if this is something that you had thought about as well.
Yeah, that's definitely a challenge. And there's no easy way to get around it that I know of, but that's certainly a lot of what I do. Mm-hmm. I talk to student groups, just try and help them understand that, because I felt, so the answer to your question, yes, I did do informational interviews.
Okay.
I do think it's a good idea to do that. But even then, you know, looking back, I realize it's still very hard to really get a feel for what working in the industry is like. Mm-hmm. It certainly helps, and I think it's absolutely the right way to go. It can be hard to get informational interviews sometimes. If you think about what you're doing, you're asking somebody for their time.
Sure.
And some people are certainly willing to do that, but they only have so much time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, if you come off as you're looking for a job, that can kind of tend to make people a little more standoffish, just because
exactly.
They run into lots of people. Everybody's looking mm-hmm. for a job, but you know, a lot of people are. And so, yes, that's a great way to start. Yes, it's a great way to begin to get an idea of what positions might be out there, especially mm-hmm. at companies you are interested in.
Sure.
But and there's still a lot to learn.
Okay. So, I mean, do you have any other examples for somebody maybe that is looking for a career in industry, somebody looking to make that transition? As you mentioned, and this is something else I wanted to point out, you actually do, you give talks and you give seminars to people interested in industry. Essentially, these are career development seminars that you've given before in addition to writing your book. So I'm curious, with a lot of the people that you've interacted with, do you have any other expert advice, any other secrets that you can offer?
I think talking to people in the industry is a great way to do it. That's one of the best pieces of advice I can get. I guess it sort of falls under this general category you hear a lot of networking.
Sure.
But, you know, there are ways to go about that. And I think that's one of the key things. Going to meetings where there will be people around isn't going to get it done for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need to build relationships over time. And any time in graduate school is not too early to start that.
Sure.
But the key that I like, one of the things I often suggest is what you really want to do the best networking, go to the other side. The worst way to network is to go around asking for a job. Hey, I've got a job. What do you need? What do you do? Right.
Mm-hmm.
People often say finding a job is very much like dating. You can't just go, you can't just go straight up to somebody and say, "Hey, I need a date. Are you?" You know, and it's the same way with a job.
Right.
Hey, I need a job. Will you give me one? Now, I'm being a little extreme, but
sure. There
are many ways you can approach people, and it can still be obvious what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
What I suggest is find some other way to interact, an excuse, if you will. Not excuse, it's got to be substantial, but something else that you can do that allows you to interact and talk to people.
Okay.
You know, so for a while, one of the last times I was looking for a job, because this applies anytime, you want to continue building a network mm-hmm. and interacting with people through your entire career. I had joined a local organization called the Colorado Photonics Industry Association.
Okay.
Being on the board of that allowed me to interact with a lot of people in the industry on something totally unrelated to a job.
Hmm.
So it gave me an opportunity to demonstrate my competence, what I'm interested in something totally removed from ever looking for a job. And then when it came time for a job, I knew these people, their some completely different premise.
Okay. Yeah, that's...
So that's something. That's the type of thing I suggest.
Okay.
Any kind of project, any kind of, you have to be creative, but what are some opportunities that can get you out there? Interestingly, my book also provided that. I wrote that book. Did the interviews at a time when I was between jobs. I had some time and did that, and that was another... use isn't a good word. I'm sure there's a better one, but an opportunity to get out and talk to people with something very substantial and show them who I was, what I was interested in, and completely independent from trying to get a job. But those are great ideas that we're building.
Okay. So I'm curious if you've had any additional difficulties or hurdles as you had been transitioning through this process or looking to make this leap or even between jobs, what kind of hurdles have you encountered and how have you essentially navigated around them? I mean, obviously, in addition to networking and staying in motion and being able to kind of interact with people outside of just mentioning you're looking for a job, do you have other ideas for navigating some of these waters? I mean, you mentioned clubs and these memberships and some other organizations outside of your work environment. So, I mean, is there something else that you've encountered that you've found a creative way of getting around?
For networking or just in general and being successful in your career?
Just in general with your career path, because again, I think something that scares brings a lot of anxiety to graduate students and postdocs is just what happens now when you encounter a hurdle or what happens when your company downsizes and you're let go. There's this idea that, you need to pick up as many translatable skills as you can while you're in academia or while you're at the job. But, it's sometimes difficult to do that on top of gaining that critical experience when you're first making that transition. So I was wondering if you had additional advice for people encountering particularly tough hurdles that maybe you can share on.
Yeah, I do have another thought. One thing I've noticed is that a lot of young career professionals who are looking in industry, scientists who are looking in industry, tend to think of what they can do in terms of specific skills.
Sure.
I see a lot of them say, I worked with this fancy type of microscope, or in my case, I could have said, I do laser spectroscopy.
Right.
That's not likely to be successful unless you feel you want to or need to do something very similar to research.
Okay.
What you want to think about, because most likely the people you're talking to in industry will say, well, I don't have that microscope, so I guess I don't need you, or I'll move spectroscopy here, so I'm not sure how you help me. An employer, a hiring manager hires somebody because they have a problem of some kind. They have some kind of thing, and they're looking for someone who can solve that. And so what you want to do to make yourself more marketable at any time, whether it's looking for a first job, whether you've been laid off, whatever you do, anytime, you want to think more about, more generically about the value you bring. Are you able to solve problems and what kinds of problems? And what are some examples? An example that I've used as a scientist, as a physicist specifically, is I say, I'm a really good technical lead. I'm not an engineer. I don't have design skills. I'm not a mechanical engineer. I'm just a CAD package or a software engineer. And I see the code. I know that can, they have a relatively straightforward path into a job. Scientist doesn't always, but I can say, I study some of everything. I understand how to talk to the mechanical engineer and software engineer and the electronics engineer because I've done some of these things. I've spent time in the machine shop and I've spent time rigging up some simple electronic circuits and things like that. And here's what I can do. I can pull a team together and help the engineers communicate with each other and make sure the final product works the way the customer needs.
Okay.
Somebody has to do that. That's often called a system engineer.
Okay.
It's that broader way of thinking about, well, what are you really capable of? Not the specific skills, but what are some broader things? And the best way to do that is to understand how to do that. Is to talk to people. Or read, and again, that's exactly what I try to help people understand with the book and seminars that I do. Help them understand a different perspective on how you go about that. Okay. It's your skill. Think about, your strengths and a broader applicability.
Yeah, that's really good advice. I think, you know, coming from the biological science, a lot of folks that I interact with in academia, they really understand industry is just, you know, or at least the possibilities in industry is just maybe another bench scientist. They really have no idea what else they can do with the skill set they have. And I think to your point, trying to understand all the other skills that you have, soft skills and hard skills, and figuring out how to market those, how they will be of interest to a company, how they would add value to the company, can really help you think in a much broader sense. I think that's really good advice. One of the other topics I want to talk a little bit more about is your actual your product or your job description. You mentioned you're a product manager, so I was curious if you can elaborate a little bit more on what a project or a product manager does, day-to-day activities, some of the responsibilities, the job requirements. If you can elaborate on that.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. I think it's a role that varies a lot from mm-hmm. company to company, but in general. So I'll describe some, but in general, and then maybe more specifically what I do, small company. Product manager is responsible for defining the product that will be sold by the company.
Okay.
Sounds sort of vague. What does that really mean? Well, you've got business development people that are gathering information from customers.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a collection of technical expertise and intellectual property that the company has sort of with the engineering group. But somebody has to say, well, what features are important? Do we need to develop? Is there new development that has to happen? How do we limit the number of options we have so we're not just selling anything that somebody will cut us a PO for?
Mm-hmm.
How do we, you know, there's a big difference between some technical widget that we could build one of and get to a customer for some money and something that's a product.
Okay.
That has specific features and is well developed and is verified in certain specs and is well validated, meaning you ensure that it actually solves the customer's problem. You know, you can create something that meets all your specs, but do you know that it actually solves the problem for your customer? Does it work the way they would hope that it would do something for them?
Mm-hmm.
That's broadly what a product manager does. It's kind of between that the sales. People who want to sell, you know, anything they can, and engineers who have certain things that they can build.
Okay.
It's kind of a liaison. In my current company, so we're moving into a number of new markets, and we're a fairly small company. We started out installing these combustion sensors on coal boilers, and now we're moving into a wide variety of areas from steel, processing, glass, hydrogen, ethylene production, things like that. And so part of the effort there is taking a system and installing it as a demonstration on a furnace in a new market.
Hmm.
And working with the plant to understand how can they actually use the data, how can they optimize it, where are the dollars that are in it, what's the value, because that's ultimately what they would need to justify
right.
it and say, oh, yeah, this is a value to us. You know, it saves us this much in fuel cost, or it reduces, you know, the credits we have to pay on nitrogen oxide emissions and various other things like that. And so it actually involves a lot of time on the site working with the plant operations team, writing up the report. And it's a little bit of a sales job then too, you know, helping them understand that, hey, this is something you need. And then going back to engineering and saying, guys, this is what they need. We need to develop it.
So there's a little bit of a liaison role that you serve, it sounds like.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
It's one of the things I find really fun.
Yeah.
Technical, it's a little bit sales, it's a little bit kind of whatever needs to be done to solve the problem to get ultimately some of the first sales.
Right. Yeah, that's. I mean, I understand the importance within the context of the company. So this is, I mean, maybe you can elaborate a little bit more on this as well. Is this a position that's normally available at large companies and small companies, or does this kind of fall into a responsibility of a different department? I mean, this seems like you mentioned, this is somewhat of a technical position. So, you know, would you anticipate, at least when you were looking, would you have anticipated larger companies to have positions like this available, as well as smaller companies and even maybe startup companies?
It's a role that many companies will have, but it's more common in larger companies.
Okay. Okay.
Quite frankly, this didn't even exist in my company until about a year and a half ago, and I sort of created it. And coming from larger companies, previously I was with JDS Uniphase that makes telecommunications hardware. There's a large company with fairly well-established products. In fact, the product that end up being supplied by a number of competitors, and so there, the product is a little bit better defined, but they had product managers still doing the work. I created this position in my current company. I think it's the difference between a product and just something that a customer will buy that you can make a few of, it's something that smaller companies tend to not often either appreciate or put the resources into.
Right.
So, but it's definitely something you'll find at larger companies.
Okay. Now, when you were when you were looking to make the transition from academia to industry, what other type of career opportunities or career paths kind of sparked your interest? Did you explore any other different opportunities, or did you know you wanted to go into industry and have more of a liaison kind of product manager type role?
Well, I certainly knew I wanted to go into industry, and I did not explore any other types of positions. However, I did not start my career as a product manager. I had no concept what that even was. I didn't really even understand what a product was. I knew how to make and how to build an experiment and get it to work. And I had worked with layers of products that I had bought and used in the lab. But I started out as more of a research scientist was the title.
Okay.
But it was really spending time in the lab developing the laser product, the next generation of it, and actually making it work. It was on.
Okay.
I focused pretty clearly on that path. Once I realized what I described before about, hey, my end is that I worked with these lab tools, these lasers for science. If I find a company that builds these, and I can say this is a great way I can bring value to you guys, and that worked pretty well, and that's what I wanted to do. So I went after companies that made a variety of laser type products.
Okay. Now, when you interact with other individuals, when you go around, I assume you've given multiple seminars at campuses and talked to a lot of folks in academia. What kind of advice do you give them? I guess now that they're in a similar position that you were, maybe getting close to grad or getting close to getting their PhD, do you tell them to start this? You should have started this earlier on, or how do you explain to them in somewhat of a comforting fashion that it's not just something, making this transition isn't something easy? Because I've heard a lot of people in academia always think they have a different mindset. They're kind of closed off in these walls of academia, sitting in the academic bubble, and they think, well, if I can't make it in academia, there's always industry. So that industry seems like the second choice that is just so easy to break into and is just waiting there with open arms for them. So I'm curious, when you're interacting with individuals, what kind of picture do you paint for them when they're making this transition?
Excellent question. I try to paint a picture of, hey, industry, if you think it's for you, it is a very rewarding place. And part of what I do is try and counter that image that I know gets, it's around a lot that, industry is kind of a second choice.
Yeah,
kind of your last resort. If you're studying science, you want to be a professor, right? Because that's the thing. And, well, if you can't cut it, there's industry. Mm-hmm. That is not at all. And that is the image. That is not at all the reality. It's a very rewarding career perspective. So much of what I say is, you may be sitting there thinking, academia is not for me, but gee, do I really want to take the second option? That's not it at all. And so I try and paint this, I paint this picture of, look, here's some people I've talked to that, made the same, they were right where you are, thought, this isn't for me. And here's some of the reasons they thought it wasn't for them. Here's why they decided to go into industry.
Right.
Here's what they're doing now, and here's what they find so very rewarding about it, and why, no one I've talked to, frankly, and then way more than the 10 in the book, nobody I've talked to, that I really made a mistake. I should have become a professor. This just is not, it is. It's just a bunch of people playing with nuts and bolts, and there's no intellectual stimulation. I've never heard that. There's plenty of intellectual stimulation. It is different. So that's the picture that I paint.
Okay.
And at the same time, then I, having given kind of that confidence, I think, I also try and help them understand how industry is different. Some of it is, how do you sell yourself? We've talked about some of that. Some of it is, how do you continue to be successful once you're there? Because you have to have a different perspective. Industry is not like academia. There are different things that are important.
Right.
And you need to develop a different mindset. If you're going to be successful, I think the skills that are sort of tend to be innate to a scientist, someone that learns a science route rather than an engineer, are kind of valuable in industry. But there are also some tendencies that you have to bring in and think about it a little bit differently.
So what, building a little bit more on that, what kind of skills would you recommend people have or start polishing up or start working on while they're in academia that would make them very marketable for industry? I mean, you mentioned a few of them. I'm curious, again, based on some of the individuals that you've interacted with and then combined with your own your real-life experience making that transition and then now working in industry, what kind of skills do you really find almost a necessity, almost a need for individuals to have?
Yeah, I think they're not so much as skills as much as perspectives.
Okay.
So one thing that you could call a skill would be communication.
Okay.
Communication skills are very important. And you hear that a lot. I mean, you need to be able to communicate. Well, sure. But there's a big difference. In academia, a lot of professors really make it kind of a star performer in their field, and they have a team of graduate students and postdocs that will do kind of whatever they say.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they don't have to communicate. In the industry, there really are no very few heroes. You have to work on a team. And it's not just a matter of, can you talk to other people? It's, can you sell them on your ideas?
Right.
You know, in industry, everybody, there's some need, some target. Somebody is paying you to meet that target. And you have to do it as quickly and effectively and efficiently as possible.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a research project where you can study it for 6 years and come up with the ideal solution, this is where you have to move forward very quickly and efficiently and accomplish the, you know, develop the product, the test, and say, yes, it's qualified,
right,
and get it out into the market. For example, you have to communicate effectively with other people. You have to tell them that, hey, no, I think this is the way to go. That's it. Convince maybe a help a customer understand why your version of the product is better than the competitor. So there's a communication there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you also really, the other things I think are largely habits. You have to think in terms of, a lot of it comes down to money.
Okay.
The fact that it's about making money, and you have to keep that in mind. That's what drives, you need to work on things that bring value in terms of dollar signs and things that are interesting. In science, you can work on things that are interesting as long as you have funding.
Right.
In the industry, you got to work on something that has a return.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be efficient. You can't, as I mentioned before, just analyze it until you think you've got all the information about it. You completely understand it and you're the expert in the field. You
right.
don't have time for that.
Right.
If you do that, whatever the opportunity is will pass you by. You have to get just the information that you can solve the problem, create the product, make it robust enough that they can get it out there. You also have to learn to make decisions without all the information.
Right.
That's a big part of it. So, I don't know if they're skills. They are in the sense that it's the things you can get better at, but a lot of it is an attitude. It's more of a focus. Keep in mind, money is behind this. It's not, we're not doing it because it's interesting. We're doing it because it's money.
Yeah. I completely agree. That seems to be the consensus for many individuals that I talk to that are in industry. You almost see this mind, their mindset change almost, almost dramatically. You interact with people in academia, and like just as you mentioned, they're very willing to sit down and analyze the data and become, their field experts, well known, every little detail about their project, every little detail about a particular piece of a mechanism or a protein or what have you. In industry, just as you mentioned, you're driven by essentially profits, and so you don't have time to know every little thing about what you're studying. You have to make some pretty quick decisions and hope that you have, in parallel, you're able to do the research and to support your clients at the same time. I think that's just such a big shift in the focus and the mindset that one has to have. And additionally, just as you mentioned, there's this client interaction that I think is very important for individuals to have good communication skills. And there's it's a big it's a big difference between giving a presentation on something you're an expert on to a bunch of other experts. It's very different when you're interacting with clients that are looking for help troubleshooting and they need you to talk to them in lay terms, or if you're trying to sell a product to somebody that's not necessarily an expert. You need to be able to explain it to a wide, wide range of audience. So I think I completely agree. Those are some good habit forming skills and that people should really focus on and pick up. So there's something else I wanted to kind of shift here a little bit and talk talk a bit about is your book. So what got you really interested in doing this? I know you mentioned you had a little bit of time in between transition from one of your positions to another. So what really sparked you to do this, and what kind of information did you get out of it? I love the idea behind it, and I've read some of the passages through there, and it seems like a very, very helpful book, because you're getting opinions from multiple people that made this transition.
Yeah, well, thank you. That's I'm glad you feel that way. It was very rewarding for me because I learned an awful lot through it. In terms of what spurred me to do it, it was a mix of, I guess, two major things. One is I was looking for a job. The site I'd been working at here had been shut down, and I was looking for another. Consolidated into the headquarters in California. So I was looking for a job, and it reminded me again of this whole thing, which I felt now I was much better at. But still, here I was selling myself as a scientist and sort of an engineer's world, and reminding myself of, okay, these are the things I need to focus on, and this is how I sell myself and sell these skills. And at the same time, I saw, a guy that turned out to be my publisher, he gave a talk at a networking event I was at, and was talking about doing interview books. He wanted to start his own little company, and that's what he was doing. He had interviewed entrepreneurs in order to start this whole thing. He wanted to start his own company. His wife said, "Why don't you interview a few people to do this before you launch it?" And that became his company, helping other people do these interview books, and it just kind of clicked that, I could go out and talk to other people who have done this same thing, scientists who got into industry, and I could make a book, because that would be useful. I sure would.
Definitely.
When I was a student, And what I learned, the same thing this guy learned in doing his entrepreneur book, is you learn so much by talking to them.
Exactly.
Some people I had never met, a couple of them I'd known for a long time, and I still learned things that I just, I never appreciated about your perspective.
Right.
That's it. So, that's how it all came together. And so, it was very interesting, and at a time when I had the time to do some of the interviews and transcriptions and editing, it takes a fair amount of time, but it was an excellent thing to do at the time.
Now, when you're going about finding or selecting individuals for these interviews, how did you go about finding these particular individuals, and what kind of demographic were you catering to? Was it the early career scientists that have already made the leap into industry, or were you trying to kind of capture the audience of people that are looking to leave academia and kind of move and make that transition, and they have all these questions?
It was primarily the latter.
Okay.
Either students, graduate students, or even people who have already made the transition, but maybe are looking at a job change, and they have all these questions. Anybody struggling with this issue of, well, I'm a scientist and I'm going into what looks like an engineer's world. How do I do that? And how do I sell myself? How do I make it a very positive thing, not just, well, I'll do the best I can. How can I help them understand there's an excellent spot out there? It's really worth a career. Go do it. That was my target audience.
Okay.
And so in terms of interviewees, I started with a few colleagues, people that I have known in the past and had discussed this topic with them, and then stretched out from there.
Okay.
People even not even in the United States.
So the target audience again was kids making the transition from academia and industry. And I think that's an important point, because there are all these resources available. Unfortunately, again, you kind of get this biased viewpoint when you're in academia that, you should just utilize resources that help move you through that pathway in academia instead of learning more about what else is out there outside of academia. And it's unfortunate that it's taken this long for so many departments or so many offices for graduate students, career services, whatnot, to really pay attention to the fact that people have diverse set of interests, and you really need to figure out what these individuals are looking for, and not necessarily just kind of force them down this one pathway because you have limited resources. And I think that that mindset is now changing a little bit more. But again, all these resources that are available for the students, it's for people in academia, it's sometimes overwhelming to try finding these or just try seeking them out. So again, that was this initially for me was one of the reasons I was so drawn to learning more about you and learning more about this book, is it seemed like such a great resource. It's just so in line with what's needed in academia right now. And I think it's very important. So in all of these interviews that you went through, was there a common theme? Did people seem to have this aha moment where they wanted to make the transition, or was it a combination of bad projects, things failing, and they just couldn't take the pace, they couldn't take the environment anymore? Or was it something that was just built into them that they didn't realize until the last 1 or 2 years, or until they were in graduate school, that they wanted to make this leap?
Yeah, good question. In terms of when they determined it, and was there some motivating issue, that was varied. There were some common elements, though. One thing that was very common among all of them was that they wanted to see the results more quickly, yes. Or they wanted to do something to make a difference. And it's that's not to say that science research, basic research, doesn't make a difference. But the timeline can be very long. One of the most interesting interviews was with Chris Myers, who was on the team that discovered Bose-Einstein condensation. This was a project at the University of Colorado that won the Nobel Prize for his advisor. And yet he ended up going directly into industry. And, I thought that was really interesting. And I think he expressed it, his story expressed it more strongly than probably anyone, but it was a common theme for everyone that, his perspective was, this was great. It was a great pinnacle in career. But the fact is, proving that Bose-Einstein condensation worked didn't really change the world. I mean, we knew it would be found eventually, and we did it. But, there's only a handful of people around the world that really understand it. I want to do something that really makes a difference.
Right.
And now he started a second company now. It's in the book that he's creating medical devices that will help diagnose HIV and other infections in remote areas in Africa, for example.
Okay.
So that really changes the world.
Yeah.
That's something where there's an immediate impact on people.
Oh, yeah.
And you can measure that. Mm-hmm. And many people express a similar kind of thing. So, I don't want to wait 10 years to see if my research becomes useful. I want to do something very fast. And of course, in industry, timelines can be, a year or 6 months.
Exactly.
When there's a big application, somebody wants a device to do something to help them, and you're going to do it. So that was the most common theme, I think.
Okay. Yeah, it completely makes sense. Again, there's a reason I think a lot of these, at least the NIH and the NSF, these workforce reports are really trying to reduce the number of years students are in these supposed training programs or these essentially contract positions when you're a postdoc, is that, at some point you would like to start seeing your return, being able to progress through in 7 years before you get a professorship after, you've been in school for so long and now you're in a postdoc or as a graduate student 5.5 years until, you can get that PhD. It's sometimes very overwhelming. And especially if you have the mentality or if you have the motivation to work in a fast-paced environment, sometimes you can get disillusioned very quickly when, you work on a project 1, 2, 3 years and then things just don't pan out and the reward, your metric of success becomes just a manuscript and you really don't get to see those real world results or those, how it's applied to something in a more broad context or developing a product or getting a patent on something. And I think people, once they start to fit in that arena a little bit more, they become more driven by some of the key metrics of success in industry rather than academia. And I think the quicker you realize that and maybe have the opportunity to talk to folks or maybe do an internship, I think it'll help help increase your confidence and figure out how to make that transition. So again, the book is probably it's probably very rewarding. I would assume when you were going through these interviews, and I would guarantee this is going to be very rewarding. This information that one would be able to take away after reading the book for a lot of graduate students and postdocs, in the absence of having opportunities to do internships or these.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, so I was hoping you can reflect back a little bit here as well, taking into consideration all the experience you have, all the individuals you've interacted with. Now, as somebody that made that leap into industry, what do you believe is the most valuable skill you picked up in graduate school?
That's a good question. Let's see. You know, I think the most valuable thing I picked up is probably just confidence.
Oh, really?
That came from, and this turns into part of how I tell myself. And honestly, solving a problem, but, it's bigger than that, right? And as a graduate student, you're given a project that can be very, sometimes, in my case, it was somewhat undefined. And you have to kind of put it together and figure out what it is that needs to be done, how you're going to move forward. There will be problems along the way. You may have to pivot and take a new direction if things don't go the way you hoped, because that's what new research is. There's a lot of unknowns. And product development is the same way. And having that confidence that, you know what, I did this. I solved whatever the problems were. If I needed something, I got into the machine shop and made it. If I, if this didn't work out the way I wanted, I did some research and tried to figure out how else can I do it. But ultimately, I made it work. I made it work myself. I may have needed other people as help, but I let it. That's big. And not only is that confidence in a valuable skill that I carry forward, but that then is part of how I saw myself.
Okay.
And that's what I want students to realize too. You know, it's what I was saying earlier about it, more broadly about what you did. Not that, hey, I used this kind of laser or this microscope. But no, I can look at projects and hear specific examples of how I did it to solve problems. Because that's what gets done in the real world.
Okay. Yeah, that I think the more and more interviews that I do with people for the website, I start to see these common themes, and it's problem solving, confidence, it's analytical skills, it's troubleshooting. All those seem to come up as reoccurring skills that they learn in graduate school that they just keep using and using and using now. It makes quite a lot of sense, especially when you think in a more in a broader sense, because it's essentially it's being able to use these skills that you probably wouldn't have necessarily defined yourself by in graduate school. But these are skills that you have. It's just being able to utilize them in a different environment. So, like you mentioned, it's not that you know how to troubleshoot just this microscope. It's actually more broad than that. You know how to troubleshoot, and you know how to think analytically, and you know how to communicate and solve a problem, and then communicate that to your team or your clients. So, I think it all just kind of comes together. One of the other questions I had that I really like to learn more about from individuals, you know, as somebody that has a PhD, what do you view as the value of having a PhD? There's a lot of talk of trying to convince people to, there's this glut of PhDs. There's so many people that have a PhD now. They're all looking for work. A lot of people have been emphasizing maybe transitioning into or having folks, instead of go into a PhD program, go into something more specific. There's a lot of these masters in biotechnology, a lot of masters, essentially training programs that get you prepared for the workforce, get you prepared for industry. So I'm curious what your take on is. What do you view as the value of having your PhD?
Yeah, excellent question. The value that I put on it, I guess there's maybe four major things. First of all, is the technical cred. A PhD has spent a lot of time learning something technical, and that gives you a certain degree of expertise. So that's the first one, but that may or may not map into whatever your career turns out to be. The other things that are important is it says this person is ambitious, and that's useful if you want to get into some kind of a leadership role. You need people that are ambitious. You need people that have initiative to get out and do things, and you need people that are self-reliant. And I think the PhD is a demonstration of all of those things. There is some talk about, hey, is it overqualified? Does it overqualify you for certain things?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. I have not experienced that myself because I don't focus specifically on the technical part.
Right.
But gee, I learned so much about quantum mechanics and laser spectroscopy, and how much of that do I use?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, but there are many other things that pull out of it. The self-reliance, the ability to demonstrate, yeah, I've got initiative, and I am ambitious, and I'm not just telling you that. This demonstrates it.
Right, exactly.
So exactly. I think there is a lot of value in that. For leadership roles, too. You know, mm-hmm. If you just want to go in and work in a lab in a company, maybe those things don't help. But if you want to get into a technical leadership role, for example, in a company and run projects and actually mm-hmm. define where is the company going, what should we do next, that fits a lot more with what you demonstrate by saying you have a PhD.
Okay. It's a very, very broad and very useful answer. I think you have quite a lot of nuggets of information in there that will be, again, the more and more of these interviews I do, there seem to be some overlapping themes, and I think you hit it, you know, hit the nail right on the head. It essentially comes down to being able to, have the skills that you need. It's not necessarily being overly technical or overly qualified. It's knowing how to use those in the environment that you're working in. So having the technical skills, having the people skills, having leadership skills, it's going to be important no matter where you're at. But it's the idea that, do you know how to market these and do you know how to sell these and translate them into a different environment? And I think that's what takes some practice, and that's what a lot of folks really, really need to learn a little bit more about. And it's very important.
It's really easy, I think, when you're looking for a job, to kind of feel like you've got your hat in your hand and you're going around saying, what will somebody give me? And from that perspective, it's easy to feel like, oh, maybe I don't have the right qualifications,
right,
but maybe you're looking for something different.
Yep.
That's not really the way you get a job, especially if you are looking at a professional career path.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the ambition to talk about. It's more about getting out there and understanding what does the company need, what the problem is, saying, here's what I can do for you. Here's where I can take this.
Mm-hmm.
That's a leadership role. That's really the kind of a thing that is more good for a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
Because what did they do? They said, you know what? I'm gonna do more school. I'm gonna do more than just get a bachelor's and go out and find a job.
Right.
I want to do some new research. I want to create something new. I want to solve a new problem. That's great. That's what you need to sell.
Right.
And that's what people are ultimately looking for the roles that really make a difference mm-hmm. within a company.
Yeah, that's, again, spot on. That's very, very good advice. I have one last question for you, and this is one that I have quite a lot of fun asking and then hearing the answer back, again, from people that have made this leap. This is, reflecting back on your transition. Now, if you were to go back to academia, put your imaginary hat on here for a second. If you were to go back into academia, you became an academic advisor, and you had, four or five trainees in your lab, how would you prepare them for the real world?
That's a good question. I think for a second here, I think I would try and focus them a little more towards the practical and say, help them understand that you've been in this academic world where it's all about new ideas and cool things and wow, what could, it's almost the world with the theoretical and what could be.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You're moving into the world of the practical and what will be or won't be what needs to be.
Right.
And think more practically about that. But then in terms of, that's more of an attitude. In terms of specific things I would suggest they do, I think can prepare you pretty well for industry, is start thinking of your research project as a real project the way it might be done in industry. And mm-hmm. put together a plan. Where do you think you're going to be going? What's the schedule? Hit some key milestones and put dates on those and try and hit them. Work with your advisor on funding. How much is mm-hmm. it really going to cost?
Sure.
And are you going to meet that? Are you not? Selling it to others? Now, there aren't always those opportunities, but sometimes you can create them. Get involved in with your advisor and kind of get funded. Because that's ultimately selling.
Right.
Hey, there's value in what we want to do. Can we get some money for it? But at the very least, having a plan and a schedule and a budget and sticking to that helps you understand, oh, gee, things don't always go the way you expect, and I have a schedule I have to meet. And
right.
It's very common for people coming out of science, I think, to they come into industry and say, okay, we need a plan. When are you going to get this done?
Mm-hmm.
The tendency is to say, well, I don't know because I haven't developed it yet. I have no idea how long it's going to take. Well, that answer doesn't work. I understand you haven't done it. Give me your best guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm paying for.
Right.
And so to practice that in school, I think, is very useful. Okay, you may not know, but there's two. You need a date. So part of that is give it your best guess.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is if this date is important, when something changes, you have to find a solution that fits within that time frame.
Right,
you know,
correct.
I'm not forcing you into that because that's the practicality. That's what comes back to somebody's paying us for this, and we have to. So that's what I would. That's definitely one piece of advice that I think helps. And be great in the first interview then when you say, well, yeah, we really learned about the project. I delivered on time. Or didn't deliver on time, but you know, I'm going to do different going forward.
Right. Yeah, it's again, it goes back to one of your comments before. It gives you confidence that you're able to kind of manage these projects, meet deadlines, estimate deadlines, and then actually execute the project so you are able to complete it, see it to completion. There's, again, I think having some of these qualifications and having this type of experience in thinking about your project in this manner is going to be very helpful when you make the transition to industry. Again, because as you mentioned, these aren't necessarily, you know, endless projects you're working on. These aren't, you know, you have until whenever you want to finish this, you know, rip it apart and know as much detail as you need to. There's, you know, there's a return on investment. There's clients you have to interact with. There's benchmarks you need to make. And it's, you're working in a lot of times in a cross-functional team where you're dependent on multiple other individuals. So you need to be able to estimate.
Right.
You need to be able to estimate when you're going to complete your piece of the project. So again,
that's right.
Very, very good advice. And I hope as you know, more and more people figure this out, that there are very noticeable differences between academia and industry. They take some of these points into consideration, some of this, and actually execute this in academia. I think many academic labs would be run much more efficiently if people thought of projects this way.
Yeah, I think they would. I absolutely think they would. There's value in running a schedule and
exactly.
Keeping yourself efficient everywhere.
Yes.
It's just, I see a lot of grad students that are able to get away with not doing that, but it still helps.
Right.
And boy, it's so much better. When you get in the industry, one of the things that can be shocking is a lot of people out there, you can run into some of the, PhD, so you like to just kind of study something forever until you know everything. And, you know, they don't want to do that. They don't want to hire that.
Right.
So if you can say, no, I solve difficult technical problems. I understand the schedule and the finance. We can't spend an infinite amount of money. We can't take an infinite amount of time. And here's what I'm very pragmatic about this. And here's an example of how I ran my research project in grad school to show that I know how to do this. That would definitely make a big note.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, well, again, thank you very much for your time, David. I really appreciate it. And again, I wanted to emphasize for those that haven't seen David's book, I highly recommend checking it out and picking it up, reading it cover to cover, and learning some of the facts about making this transition and learning from individuals that have made this transition, their experience. The book is called Turning Science into Things People Need. And again, our guest today was David Giltner. And I'd like to, again, thank David for spending some time with us and sharing his information and his experience. So thank you, David.
Yeah, well, thank you, Brian.